This is the 19th class in the then and now. February 26th, 2008, looking at refuge, the vow of individual freedom leading into the Bodhisattva vow. Last week, we looked at the three jewels, looking at them, as they say in the Tibetan tradition, the outer, inner, and secret. One way of thinking about these, or the outer, inner, and secret interpretations or of the three jewels, one way of thinking about outer, inner, and secret is the outer has to do with what we experience in terms of what we see, what we hear, what we touch, what we sense, really through the senses. So that's the historical Buddha and the teachings that have come down to us through the centuries in the Buddhist canon, and the Sangha of those who take have taken monastic ordination. The inner refers to the, I'm not sure what quite what the best word is for it, but the you might say the principles or the ideals. So at this level, or in this way of interpreting the three jewels, the inner is the Buddha principle, the principle of being awake. The Dharma is the actual experience of the teachings rather than just the understanding of the teachings. So it's the arising of compassion in our experience rather than just understanding what compassion is. And the Sangha, in this interpretation, and the Tibetan tradition, is the Noble Sangha, refers to bodhisattvas. So it is that sense of engaging this practice deeply for the welfare of others and being inspired by the ideals of compassion and emptiness and so forth. And then the secret, this is what we could also call the mystery. Again, I want to emphasize that mystery here means something that can be experienced but can't be put into words. So this interpretation, level of interpretation, then Buddha is the emptiness of experience. The Dharma is clarity, a clarity of mind which makes it possible to know. And the Sangha is the unrestricted arising of experience without confusion, without falling into confusion. Now, the question that I asked you to consider and want to discuss with you for a little while is what needs to happen for you to take refuge seriously? You all recall that question? So, what needs to happen? Molly.
I'm not sure I like the term taking it seriously.
It's on.
But I kind of got past that. And I came to this like constant returning, kind of like meditation itself. commitment, vigilance. I also came to the question, well, the other thing that came to me was a need or I would need to let go of a sense of who I think I am or my identity or myself, which was one of my questions, I guess, sort of like, what does that mean? And then you asked about physical and emotional.
What arises physically, emotionally when you entertain this question?
So I came to a softening sadness.
Okay.
Kind of like there needs to be this like taking down of all the boundaries.
I'd like to clarify my question because when I listen to you, it seems that you're you may be describing what taking refuge, the result of understanding or actually taking refuge would be. When I use the term that you don't like, taking it seriously, I meant something closer to what you referred to in your answer, which was a sense of commitment. So another way of posing this question is, what would be required for you to take this on as a commitment for yourself, of course? That's really what it is. And that's what I was getting at. So can you elaborate on that?
Well, I could go in the direction of actual time commitment in my life.
Again, you're one step further than what I'm trying to get at. I mean, I'm not asking you what commitment would you be willing to make, etc. I'm asking... Here, last week we discussed these ideas, okay? And they seem to make sense, etc. And between hearing about those ideas and like coming to the direct experience of the emptiness, clarity, and unrestricted experience, there's a path of practice. And as you say, the path of practice is going to take a commitment in time and energy, etc. So that's here. What I'm talking about is how to go from having heard about these to the point, okay, this is something that's really important, then I'm going to act on it. What needs to happen there? You follow?
Yeah. I'm not sure
Okay.
Have
all right. Randy.
I know for me what put me over that threshold was the realization that what I was doing wasn't working. And I wasn't happy with my life.
Okay. Chuck.
I wasn't here last week, but I think one of the important things is impermanence and death. They make you see what's important.
Yes, well, I think that's very true. So, but that's what pushes you over the threshold. Okay. Anybody else? Susan.
There were a couple of things. One is I was remembering what Shanti Deva had said about how you must feel a disgust for this life. And it didn't make complete sense to me, you know, at the time, but I can sort of see what he means. I don't quite know how to explain it, but it's about It's kind of knowing. knowing what's possible and experiencing what is. I guess it's the best way.
Okay. I mean, one way of talking about that disgust for this life is to be very clear. That in saying that, Shantideva is referring to what the phrase I like to use, disgust for the world in which we think we live in, which is this world of shared experience, and saying, "Oh, I can't find any peace or satisfaction in that world," and so we let go of that and start dealing with the world of actual experience.
Yes. Okay. And I guess I just wanted to add the other part of that is there's a feeling of opening and being where you're supposed to be. When that does happen, that also provides the impetus to commit to
that work. Steve, did you have a comment?
Propelled me, I think, initially was a rising sense of an imbalance and between some clarity in some areas and none in others. And it was so what did it take or what does it take was feeling that there was a split happening.
Okay. Anybody else? Linnea?
Some variety of failures, humiliations, and close calls.
So I should lead new students into dangerous situations, should I? Okay. Pardon? They'll get into dangerous situations without any help from me. I see. Okay. I want to go a step further here. I'm going to have to be more explicit in my question and stop hinting around. Most of you here have taken the vow of refuge, I think. Possibly everybody. What was the significance of that for you? Why was that important? The silence is deafening.
For me, it was a commitment to be willing to look,
mm-hmm.
even when I forget to look.
Okay. Why was it important to take a vow, to go through such a ceremony? Because I know a few of you were quite persistent, and you bugged me for anywhere from 6 months to a year. Okay, how long was it, Molly?
Yeah.
So, obviously it was something important that you felt you needed, which is, and no criticism here, I think this is very good, but what was important? This is what I want to get at. Do you want to say any more? It wasn't enough just to, and this is what was where I was trying to go with that question, what needs to happen to take it seriously, because okay, you can read about it, take it in, study, learn it in the class, etc. And as you say, take in death and permanence. What did you say? Many failures and a few close calls.
Yeah, some combination of failures, humiliations.
And close calls, right. But there's something else that each of you felt was important and necessary.
For me, it was externalizing the knowing, ritualizing it in a certain way, means that there's something when I cannot connect to it practice experience or whatever, that
something occurred in time.
Something occurred in time, and it's something to return to.
Okay. Anybody else?
I was just going to say, there's something about doing a ritual like that in front of people, and also kind of making a commitment to your teacher,
mm-hmm.
or the person who gives refuge, or
yes.
conducts a ceremony.
And what is that?
I don't know.
Interesting. Okay. Julia, you have anything to say on this?
I was thinking along the lines of what Linnea was saying about commitment.
Go on.
It's a willingness to keep, you're basically committing to a path where you continuously open to what you don't know. So it's a path of exploration and opening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost a it's a step that's a representation of a faith in a process.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination, really, of a commitment and a and a step into faith, really, I think is the way I put it.
And why is that important to do? Why is it important to ritualize it?
Because there's no going back.
Why is there no going back if you don't ritualize? Why is there no going back only if you ritualize it?
Because I think the mind is very sneaky.
Okay.
So you can say, well, you know, I had my fingers crossed behind my back, or I did it on Wednesday and I wasn't feeling so well, or something. Or
nobody was looking.
Nobody was looking, that's right. Like eating... I'm eating chocolate standing up, so it doesn't have any calories in it. So, but it's different when you do it publicly. You're witnessing something, so there's a sense of, you know, I suppose in that sense it is kind of like a marriage where you're standing up and declaring something.
Yes.
It does make a difference.
Yeah.
I guess I don't quite understand the mechanism by which it makes a difference, but it does.
Well, this is what I'm inviting everybody to explore in this question.
Mm.
Yeah, Kara.
No, I just when Julia said that, I just thought it's like the spiritual equivalent of just moving in together or getting married.
Yeah.
Because when you are just living together in your separate space, there's always the opt out, but marriage requires a lot more.
It's more difficult to opt out of marriage.
It's a lot more difficult to opt out of.
Okay, Randy?
For me, a big part of the ritual is getting out of my head and not intellectualizing it and experiencing moving into a space that other people have gone before. And it's kind of joining that path.
Joe.
It occurs to me that what happens when I personally make a vow is that, or a promise, is that I use a lot of mechanisms that in other circumstances might not be very fruitful or skillful. And I use those mechanisms in the service of something that will be more skillful and fruitful. For example, it's important to me to feel that I'm a person who keeps their promise. So it's a sense of self that's involved there. But it's in service of something that I think is worthwhile. So what I'm doing is building a bond and, in a sense, concretizing or not concretizing self, but using a mechanism which would lead to a sense of self in service of something other than self.
Yes, I think there's something a little mysterious about all of this, because if we go back to distinction that Susan was raising, that this is about letting go of our seeking security or safety in the life in which we think we live, and finding it and looking for not really security or safety, but freedom from the vicissitudes of experience in the act of experience itself, the emptiness, clarity, and unrestricted arising. But as several of you have eloquently expressed, doing this, making that commitment in the world in which we think we live, actually provides an impetus, a power or support for that more interior exploration. It's quite interesting. I mean, in a certain sense, when you're taking refuge, you're saying, this is, I'm taking, you're saying in the world and of shared experience and interaction, I'm out of here, and I'm serious about this. Steve.
I'm wondering if there's a certain exercise, as we've talked about, once you said that there was someone who decided that every time a door shut or closed during the day, they'd...
Yeah.
That if it's not that different, that it's just another way, tool, to remember what we're doing.
Oh, I think so, yes. It's a very powerful tool. Yeah. And what I'm trying to explore is the power. How does it have so much power? And how is that... Why is that power important, and so forth? Yeah, Randy, you had a comment. Joe.
A little more about what I'd said before about taking a path others have taken, which is that there's a sense that there's a safety net. Sitting in the not knowing is scary,
mm-hmm.
and staying in the not knowing is even scarier,
mm-hmm.
and the safety net, the grounding, the foundation of doing that is knowing that others have done this before. And I think that's, for me, the part of that ritual.
Okay. Julia, you had a comment? There's one other person. Yes. Okay.
Yes, my comment was similar in the sense that you say that we're doing this in the world of shared experience, but it's a different world of shared experience, I would argue, than the one of everyday life, in the sense it is the shared experience of people who collectively have committed to this path or are in the process of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So Randy's talking about antecedents. I'm talking about something that's more contemporaneous. But this idea of a series of individuals making a commitment to something, which is to be awake in their own lives, is something that is collectively outside of the sort of social programming or norms that would normally... Most rituals are to indoctrinate people or include people into social hierarchies. This is a different kind of a ritual, where it's sort of collectively you're jumping off the cliff, if you like, together.
Yes.
So it has a very different flavor from other types of more highly socialized rituals.
Okay. Susan.
Another possibility is that there are also three levels to the actual ritual itself. There's outer, inner, and secret. And especially when it's conducted with a field of awareness. So if you're talking about the mysterious, who knows what's happening on these other levels? You know, it could penetrate in a certain way.
All right. Okay. Any other comments anybody would like to make on this before we... Because this is a way of leading into looking at the vow of refuge itself. Linnea and Joe? Okay.
For those of us who waited a very long time to take refuge, I think that part of, or relatively speaking, part of what's significant is it's an acknowledgement, at least in my case, but of gratitude, but also an acknowledgement of the experience of the practice itself.
Okay, yes. Joe?
I'm just wondering whether it can be unpacked even more than as far as we've taken it here. The actual answer I got to, after going through all the stages of the questions you asked, and physical, emotional, and story-wise, the actual answer I got to on a concrete level was I need to unpack it for myself a little bit more. From what, so that it's even simpler, and I think one can. I haven't yet, but I have the intuition that it can be unpacked again.
I see. Okay. Let's turn to page 141 in Kensho Gyaltsen's translation. In Gunter's translation, it is what did you say? Oh, the method, it's 103. 103 in Gunter's translation. It says, in the common ceremony, the disciple supplicates the master to perform the ceremony. The master makes offerings in front of the three jewels. If this cannot be arranged, the disciple visualizes the three jewels in space and mentally do prostrations. And the disciple repeats after the master, please hear me, all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please hear me, master. My name is, from this time until I achieve enlightenment, I take refuge in all the Buddhas, the supreme beings among the two legs. That's literally what the prayer says. In Tibetan, it's Kangyi Namchi Chok, which means the supreme among the two-leggeds, which refers, of course, to humans, not to birds. thank you. I take refuge in the Dharma, the supreme freedom from all attachments. Yes, Dochok Don Trawi Namji Chok. And I take refuge in the Sangha, the most excellent of all communities. The longer ceremony, the more involved ceremony, goes through three stages: preparation, which is basically creating suitable conditions for the expression or the establishment of this motivation, then the actual ceremony. And you see that the word is, wording is the same. There are a few more steps. And in the this more involved ceremony, you'll see at the bottom of page 142 this quotation from the Naga King Anavatapti Requested Sutra. This is referring to the deeper level of refuge, what we call the secret or mystery level. And I want to go through this because this is very a good example of what I think are certain translation problems. Those who realize all phenomena are non-existents and have no form, no perception, no characteristics, see the Buddha perfectly. That is taking refuge in the Buddha. Okay, I want to focus on the phrase, realize all phenomena are non-existent and have no form, no perception, and no characteristics. What do you understand by that? What is comparable in one in Gunther is, by knowing all entities to be non-existent, to see them as incapable of being given form and primary characteristics, of being taken as entities in themselves, but to see them as being perfect Buddhahood is taking refuge in the Buddha. Anybody want to explain that one? No, a lot of shaking of heads. It's kind of like gobbledygook, isn't it? It's going to make me popular. First off, the term realize. It's used quite frequently in spiritual circles as in a realized person and come to realization. When I first encountered Buddhism many years ago, that was pretty standard vocabulary. But whenever I looked up realize in the dictionary, the first meaning of realize is to make to bring something into being, as in realize a profit. So you've bought something at $5, it's now worth $10. When you sell it, you realize the profit. Yeah, you make the gain real. Now you have actual cash in hand. And I always had a difficult time figuring out what that had to do with spiritual understanding. This is an example of a word which has come, I'm not sure if who started using the word realize in this sense, but it's a word that has gained a particular meaning in the context of spiritual practice and is actually quite divorced from everyday English, which is one of the reasons why. And so, who realize all phenomena are non-existent. Now, what most people come to mean is that there's something has changed. But I think it's important to make this much more specific. The word, I can't remember what the word is in Sanskrit, but the word in Tibetan is dokpa. And to the best of my understanding, it has the meaning of knowing directly, unmediated by the intellect, unmediated by emotional projections and so forth. It is direct and immediate knowing. Now, there is actually quite a bit of Western lore which doesn't even acknowledge such a form of knowing, that all knowing has to be conceptual. This is not true, of course, but there are certainly schools of thought in Western circles say that, you know, it doesn't. They don't have any notion of this a knowing that is unmediated by intellect or emotional projection or anything like that. Now, the second word that is extremely problematic here from my perspective is the word phenomena. It's a Greek word and arises as in the pair noumenon and phenomenon. Noumenon referring in some way to the spirit or the knowing spirit, and phenomenon referring to what is known, i.e. things out there. So whenever we use the word phenomena, we are talking about the objective pole or the object pole of experience. But this is not what is meant here. The word, of course, in Tibetan and in is chu, which is dharma in Sanskrit, and doesn't refer solely to the object pole. It refers to experience itself. It can be an experience of self. It can be experience of knowing. It can be. It isn't just a knowing, a sensory object or a projected object of any kind. So this could be recast as those who know directly that all experience doesn't exist as entities. That's what non-existent is, means to. And existence here has a very definite meaning in Buddhist. It means it exists on its own. It has it isn't dependent on anything else. But all experience, from the Buddhist point of view, arises in relation to something else. And arises in relation to a subject. If it's an object, if it's a subject, it rises in relationship to an object. If it's an object, it rises in relation to a subject. And in this sense, no experience exists independently. And it doesn't mean, it's not actually talking about objects like water bottle. It's talking about the experience of form, like round, things like that. These things don't exist in and of themselves. Now, this is a much more accessible experience than most people think. To know that everything is non-existent means that everything has to disappear. That's how I'd know it. But no, it's much more accessible than that. It means you come into this direct knowing, and even though things arise, you see very, very directly that they are, to use the traditional metaphors, because they're totally appropriate, they're rising like reflections in a mirror. Now, the reflection of an object in a mirror doesn't exist as such, but it's a vivid experience. And this is what this is referring to here. And have no form, no perception, and no characteristics. Again, that's referring to, I think Gunter's translation actually is better here. Uh, He says, see them as incapable of being given form and primary characteristics. One might say that they don't have actual form. Like, for instance, if you look at the reflection of an object in a mirror, it appears to have form, but there isn't anything there which has form. It appears to have, you know, be something, but there isn't anything there which actually is something. Do you follow? Okay. That's what this is referring to. Now, then the next thing, to say that to see them are being taken as entities in themselves, that's good. But the next phrase, but to see them as being perfect Buddhahood. And Kenjo Jozen says, see the Buddha perfectly. Here, Buddha means, in a very damn sense, emptiness. And what they're saying is, when you experience directly the ephemerality of experience, that is know, and I would prefer to use the word knowing rather than seeing. That is knowing the nature of things. That's taking refuge in Buddha. You follow? Then, one who realizes all phenomena are the nature of Dharma Dhatu is taking refuge in the Dharma. Erg. I would prefer to translate this as, when you experience directly that all experience is pure being, which is the clarity aspect of mind, that's taking refuge. Now again, if we go back to our example of the mirror, on the one hand you have the emptiness of experience, of the forms of mirror, that there isn't anything there. On the other, you have the fact that they appear vividly. You see them. When you experience that vividness and emptiness simultaneously, okay, you know what you're seeing. You're seeing a reflection in the mirror. Okay. Similarly, when you experience the vividness of experience and the no-thingness that we've just been referring to, then your relationship with experience shifts, and there's a clarity, a natural clarity, and you understand experience as in a very rough sense, as a kind of a manifestation of that clarity. Then your relationship with it shifts. It's no longer seen or regarded as something other. This is taking refuge in the Dharma at the secret level, or the level of mystery. And then one who realizes that the composite and non-composite are non-dual is taking refuge in the Sangha. What does Gunter do with that? I prefer Gunter's translation here. To see the conditioned and unconditioned as not to be split up into a duality. Now, one way of getting at this, the story is told of Dogen, that he came across a couple of monks who are arguing about the nature of things. They were looking at a flag that was flapping in the wind and trying to determine whether it was the flag that moved or the wind that moved. And Dogen just said, you're both wrong. It's the mind that moves. Another teacher, sometime later, said, Dogen was wrong too. I agree with that teacher. I can't remember his name. When you see things directly, there may be the appearance of movement, but there is no movement. Nothing, there is nothing to move. Sounds a little strange. And so what they're referring to here is that when you're completely present, then experience arises without restriction. And there isn't any sense of it being composite or not composite, or conditioned or unconditioned. It is just experience. One actually moves beyond that duality. That duality happens to be very useful in describing the path and so forth, but they aren't intrinsic qualities of any experience. So, does this help that make this paragraph a little more comprehensible? Julia.
In the flag, is there not also a dynamic element there, in the sense that when you're completely present, you're not revisiting the past, which is where the flag was the moment before?
That doesn't arise there, actually. Because well, I suppose in the sense that there isn't a sense of time.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. See, time is dependent on a sense of self. Now, we know this. When you have a headache, how quickly does this time pass?
Very slowly.
When you are completely engaged in something, how quickly does time pass?
Can't say.
Yeah. So there's a very intimate relationship between time and self, or sense of self. Okay. Any other questions or comments on this before I move on? Now, if one happens to experience this when taking refuge, that's very good. But basically, what's happening most of the time in the ceremony of taking refuge is the seed for that experience is being planted, or one's being oriented in that direction. Then the third part of this is a conclusion where you make any make offerings and so forth out of gratitude for that. Now, as we discussed at the beginning, rituals are important. They're important for all the reasons that you described. One of the principal ones being, or a couple of the principal ones being, that something takes place at a certain time and it renders one accountable and prevents one from saying, as Julia was saying, you know, you had your fingers crossed, so forth. It's not absolutely necessary that be ritualized, because some people are able to make commitments on their own and to make that shift. But for many people, it's just extremely helpful. Part of that is that ritual, the physical acting out and the going through a process, is not simply an intellectual process. It's there's an emotional and physical process, so it speaks to us and resonates with us at a deeper level. And that, I think, is one of the primary purposes of ritual, is that it engages the whole person rather than just a part of it. And we can read this book and go, yeah, that's a really good thing, yeah, I'm going to do that. But that doesn't penetrate very deeply when we are present in front of another person and say, I'm going to do that. The squirm factor is much higher. Many of you know that one of my favorite books is by Uchi Amaroshi, the Refining Your Life. And I was at a Buddhist teachers conference in 2001, and I ran into a monk who'd actually met Uchiyama. And basically studied at his monastery for a year. Didn't have a lot of contact with him, but was allowed to be present when Uchiyama was conducting an ordination ceremony for some monks. Now, in Japanese Zen tradition, everything is completely scripted. That is, before you go into the ceremony, somebody takes you through the whole ceremony and says, well, you know, the abbot is going to say this, and you say this. And then the abbot will say this, and you say this, and the abbot will say this. And so you know your lines completely. There are no surprises whatsoever. This monk that I was talking with said, Uchiyama's presence was so powerful and his voice so piercing that when he asked, are you going to take on this commitment, blah, 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 and the monks would say, yes, I'm going to take on this commitment, the new monks were sweating with fear. It was really being taken into them very, very deeply. Even though they everything had been scripted, they were just the presence of the moment was such, like, and they were really, really feeling it. One other comment on ritual. Rituals such as refuge and most rituals and most rites develop from a desire to celebrate the value of these kinds of understandings. And that celebratory aspect is very, very important. I mean, celebration very closely related to joy. And it really is an expression of joy, which is put into a ritual form. What tends to happen is that once it's put into a ritual form, then the emphasis shifts to observing the form, and the sense of celebration and joy tends to fade away. And one loses connection with it, and that's when the celebratory rites become empty rituals. So we're going to be discussing the Bodhisattva vow in quite a bit of detail over the next couple of weeks. And I just wanted to put this note in there, because even though it's a very formal ritual, it is really a celebration of this arising of this form of motivation, this sort of motivation in the individual, And that celebratory aspect is very, very important to keep in mind. Refuge itself, the refuge vow, is also a celebration of the arising of the recognition. Oh, I mean, I think as you were putting it, Randy, this life isn't working for me. That's being celebrated. And I think this is another reason why such rituals are important, is that it's not only you or the aspirant here making a declaration or making a commitment in the presence of another person. It is that other person, whether it be the teacher or other people who are present, celebrating in this very ritual form the arising of this. So it's also a, if you put it in simple psychological terms, it's a being seen. But if we interpret that in spiritual terms, it's also by being seen, you have an experience of not being separate from this way of being. And so I think it's not just the part of making a commitment, it's also being seen and being celebrated. And if you remember discussions we've had about power, the there's a close relationship, a very close relationship. Joy is the emotion that is associated with power. So that in terms of the immeasurables, when somebody celebrates what you are doing, this plants a seed, which is your connection with power. And that's very important in the context of both of these vows, because it is that the willingness to just go and do what is necessary, which is a principal aspect of power, that seed is being planted, or that potential or possibility is being planted in you through this ceremony. Not only by you making the commitment, but by also you it being recognized and celebrated by others. Okay? Any comments or anything anybody wants to say on that? Steve?
I'm just thinking about that on a more sort of basic level, that when you do any kind of ceremony, you're physicalizing something that you were thinking about. You're giving it a physical manifestation, which is walking and doing the thing. And for one thing, we remember physical actions more than thoughts. And so it's just something that it's making physical something that if we just thought about, wouldn't imprint as much, I think.
I think you're quite right. Randy, one right here.
Long time ago, you described three ways of knowing, an intellectual knowing, emotional knowing, and a perceptual knowing.
Roughly, yeah.
And you'd used a phrase that stuck with me, which seems to be coming up now, which is that your way of relating to the world changes. And the realization, I think, at least for me, taking refuge, is that it changed how I behave in the world.
That's where we're going next. Thank you. Great segue. Okay. There's the training in refuge. And this is what's on page 143 and following. Or page 143, sorry. The three general trainings, honoring the three jewels, which is something you can ritualize in your life one of the ways is whenever you sit down to eat, you offer the food to the three jewels. It's equivalent to the Christian grace. You're not actually asking for a blessing. You're just making an offering. You're making an offering to them. And bowing to the three jewels. All of these are ways of honoring what you have come to be the basic orientation in one's own life. Time and time again, I'm asked, you know, when you bow in Buddhism, why do you bow and who are you bowing to? Because from the perspective of the Ten Commandments, this is, I mean, really bad stuff. You know, in Buddhism, we don't settle for small graven images. We like really big things. This comes up when you go up to Mount Baldy and somebody's new and saying, why do we bow when you go into the Zendo and so forth? Bowing has always been a very important part of Buddhist practice. It's regarded as an antidote for pride because you're lowering your body. It is a form of practice which everybody follows. And so, I mean, when the Dalai Lama comes into a temple, he does three prostrations in the same way that any of us does. When Kala Rinpoche enters temples, or entered temples, he would always do that himself. It's not restricted. I mean, age has nothing to do with it, so forth. And we bow to Buddha because not as a savior or as a creator or even as a higher being of any kind, but as a person who showed us what is possible and showed that it's possible to come to this awakening, which we call Buddha. And so when one's bowing to the Buddha, one is acknowledging that potential and honoring it within oneself. And this is why many people have a shrine or a small place in their house, which is where they have a Buddha image and or something along those lines, because it is a way, a symbol, again, of making a place for that in their lives. This has nothing to do with worship in the sense of asking to get something. There are many, many people who practice that in Buddhism, but that is not what Buddhist practice is about, which is why the Dalai Lama has on more than one occasion said that most people who practice Buddhism would be much happier in another religion. There are such things as worship and so forth. Not forsaking the triple jewel, even at the risk of one's life or for great rewards. Again, this goes back to what we discussed in the discussion of faith several chapters ago. Stuff comes up on us. And we let go of that commitment to know the empty clarity of experience and get caught up in our confusion. We go step out of that life of immediate experience. That's what's being referred to here. Repeatedly taking refuge by recollecting the qualities of the triple jewel, the more that we take this in, just reminding ourselves, repeating prayers and verses which reflect that, then this is just a way of instilling it, these perspectives and this way of approaching life more and more deeply in us. The three particular trainings, having taken refuge in Buddha, one should not take refuge in other deities. Other deities here means taking anything else as a source of ultimate refuge. So, you know, feeling that medicine will save us, feeling that a relationship will save us, feeling that money will save us. And there are many people who do precisely this. You know, the perfect tan, the perfect hair. The perfect clothes. I mean, you may think I'm being specious here, but I've actually had this discussion with, those are actual discussions I've had with people. You know, well, I could never wear that. I could never dress like that. You know, as if dressing a certain way protected them from something, ultimately. Having taken refuge in the Dharma, one should not harm other sentient beings. The reason for this is that the intention of the Dharma is to end suffering. If we're causing suffering for other beings, we're going against the basic intention of the Dharma. Now, many years ago, very long time ago, in the 70s, I was in Seattle visiting some friends that I'd met originally at Rinpoche's monastery in India. And there was a very distinguished lama visiting Seattle at that time, Dingo Chensei. And they were hoping that their 7-year-old son would choose to take refuge with Dingo Chensei. And they were quite upset that he was completely adamant that he was not going to. And so while I was saying them, I was sitting on the doorstep with Jesse, this young boy. And so I just brought it up casually. I said, so you aren't going to take refuge with Dingo Chensei? I just said, no way. And I said, oh, why is that? And he said, look, it's bad enough. You walk along the sidewalk, you step on an ant. That's worth kalpas in hell. Once you take refuge, it's way worse than that. I'm not going to do that. So I explained to him a little bit that it was difference between unintentional and intentional action. So that relieved his anxiety. So he ended up taking refuge, and his parents were very happy. The fact is, we're going through the course of life, it is impossible to go through the course of life without causing difficulties for others. You know, we drive down the street and bugs smash into our windshield. You know, it's endless. But to the extent that we can, then we don't cause harm for others. And I also make a distinction between hurting others and harming others. Harming others is causing them real damage. There are lots of situations where somebody may have hurt feelings or something like that. We need to do things either because of our work or family obligations, which, you know, it's going to hurt somebody. But it's not done with the intent of harming them, and hopefully it's done in a way which doesn't actually harm them. I just found that that's a useful distinction for me. Anyway, maybe it's helpful for you. Having taken refuge in the Sangha, one should not rely on heretics. Well, it's a bit strong. The ideal here is that you, and this goes very much to what Julia was saying about taking refuge, that you hang out with like-minded people. Now, that in here in Los Angeles and most quarters of the contemporary world, it's not possible because we live in a pluralistic society. We don't get to choose everybody with whom we work or interact. So insisting that we only interact with certain people, well, I mean, it'd be possible if we could create a whole community And to some extent, Christian fundamentalists do exactly this. They want to have Christian fundamentalist psychotherapists and accountants and attorneys and so forth, because there's a shared understanding there. My interpretation of this is that in the circumstances of our lives, we're going to interact with people, but these are not the people who we are influenced by in what is crucially or centrally important in our lives. What is crucially and centrally important in our lives, we associate with people who have similar things like that. So we have that reinforcement and support. And that's basically the idea of, or the central idea connected with Sangha. Sangha is often translated as community, but community often carries the idea of mutual dependence. You know, everybody forms a community, and this person does one thing, and this person does another, and all the different functions are taken together. The Sangha taken care of by different people in the community. The Sangha doesn't mean community in that sense. If it does mean community at all, it's a community of shared intention. And that's actually the word in Tibetan. The word for Sangha in Tibetan is Gendun. Ge is the word for virtue, and Dun is the word for to seek or to intend. So that these are people who intend virtue. And understanding Sangha as a community of shared intention rather than a community of mutual dependence is a very important distinction in my mind. The three common trainings are to respect the Buddha jewel in every form, even a piece of tsatsa. Tsatsa is a miniature replica which is used in various ceremonial forms in Tibetan Buddhism. To respect the foundation of the Dharma jewel, the books and the texts of the precious Dharma, even one syllable, and to respect the precious Sangha jewel, the dress of Buddha, even a patch of yellow cloth, yellow or saffron being the cheapest of dyes in India, and hence that was the color that was used. Now, there are different interpretations. If there's a cheaper dye in your country, that's the one you should be using for the robes, which is why many of the monks in Japan wear gray. But the intention of this last one is that to bring attention to every aspect of one's life, so that you aren't neglecting or evading your commitment in even very subtle ways. That's what I think the intention here is. Now, people can get really uptight about this stuff. And we've had plenty of that over the last few decades with people. The letter A represents the perfection of wisdom, and you let that letter fall on the floor. Well, we have a hard time in our society because we've got print all over the place. And who knows what the karma is for trashing Dharma document on your computer without going through the proper ritual. I'm being a little facetious here. What is it? Because it's not ones and zeros. We have all these depictions of Buddhas all over the place. And there was the case of Victoria's Secret putting out that Buddha Dakini a few years ago, which just sent the Buddhist world nuts. You can still look it up; it's online. But the Buddha images on this bikini, which was actually quite popular, but there was a media write-in campaign to Victoria's Secret from Buddhists all over the world. and Korean government got into terrible trouble because when it put image of Buddha on their currency. In a pluralistic society, I don't know how we handle this stuff. Each of us have to make our own decisions about what's appropriate or not. But you can get the general sense of it. In Korea, Buddhists felt it was terrible to associate Buddhism with currency. And I can see that. At the same time, large Buddha image was a symbol for the country of Korea. So I can also see the government's point of view. And these are the kinds of things we have to wrestle with. The next section is about the benefits of refuge. I think it's worth reading through those, interpreting them on an internal basis more than on a... So when you see things like... I want to point out another strange English, which has crept into a strange form of English, right on the bottom of page 143. Refuge becomes a cause for purification of all the negative karmas accumulated earlier. Well, if I give you a bit of gold ore and ask you to purify, what do you purify? You purify the gold. You don't purify the gold, the stuff that makes it impure. But here you purify the negative karma. No, we don't purify the negative karma. That would make pure negative karma. And one has to be very alert because these kinds of idiosyncratic usage of English have crept into Buddhism. It's very unfortunate because it makes it into a kind of Buddhist hybrid English. One will not fall into the lower realms. And just picking that one out as an example, when you take refuge, you're forming an intention. If that intention is formed deeply enough, as some of you have said, it changes your relationship with life. In particular, it changes your relationship with some of those very basic emotional reactions. You may go there, but you can't go there in the same way because you know there's something wrong about it. And wrong not in the moral sense, but wrong in the sense that it's against this intention. It's not helping you wake up and be present. Now, the rest of the chapter is on what is called the Pratimoksha in Sanskrit. Is it 9:30 already? Yeah, I think we can. I just want to cover this very quickly. Pratimoksha is the another form of ordination. It's the its technical name is the ordination of individual freedom, and concerns specific actions. The core of it are four actions: not to kill a human being, not to steal anything of value, and anything of value means a week's supply of rice or more. So you can translate that into our culture. Not to lie about your spiritual attainments, and not to have inappropriate sexual relations. For a monk or nun, that means celibacy. For a lay person, it means one is has sexual relations within the context of the relationship one is in. Now, those form the core of the individual freedom vows. So there isn't actually a vow in Buddhism that you aren't going to take life. It's the when you take this vow, these vows, you aren't going to take the life of a human being. It's extended in principle to you avoid taking life as much as possible, but that is the actual vow. There is a fifth vow which is also regarded as important, and that is not to take anything that has been fermented. That's more usually generalized more now to not taking any form of intoxicants. And the reason for that is that intoxicants cloud your mind and prevent you from acting appropriately, and is regarded as very important, because when you're clouded by intoxicants, you can do any of the other four. Now, it goes through these various reasons. Why is this important? And there, all of this is being talked about as a basis for the Bodhisattva vow, which we'll be starting on next week. Being able to restrain your actions is a form of discipline, so you aren't acting out of emotional reaction all the time. Developing that ability to act intentionally rather than reactively is a suitable basis for forming the Bodhisattva resolution. Also, as we've discussed in other contexts, when you act morally, when you act virtuously, the mind is naturally clearer and lighter. You have the scriptural authorities, and they're endless. He just quotes one or two here, and then goes through the various kinds of reasoning. You may ask, why don't I give this level of ordination? It's because I'm not a monk. One actually has to take this level of ordination, at least the way I was trained, from someone who has the complete ordination, which is the monastic thing, where those four basic vows are elaborated into 253, or in the case of women, into 360-something. And the reason for that is that those who have devoted themselves full-time are regarded as being the repository of those vows. Now, there are other Buddhist traditions in which there is a tradition of lay people providing the basis of ordination to lay people, but that wasn't the tradition of my own training. For myself, the way I approach this, most of you are familiar with the 10 non-virtuous acts. I take those as very good guidelines. They include all of this. And I just close with a story from my time with Rinpoche in India. One day, this couple showed up. They'd been driving around India with a caravan. Now, if any of you know the roads in India, they're difficult enough to negotiate with a car. And this is back in the 70s when the roads were much worse. And here they were driving around India with this large caravan. And he was quite a character, this guy. He sat down, Rinpoche, and described how he traveled to galaxies and solar systems all over the universe, and met all of these incredible beings everywhere, and he was just delighted to meet this another credible being, i.e. Kala Rinpoche. And so this discussion went back and forth, and before he took his leave, he said, if there's one thing you want me to tell people, Rinpoche, what is it? What is your message to the universe? Because I will go and spread it. And I just had to hand it to Rinpoche. He said, and he quoted this very famous verse, which was one of Rinpoche's favorites, but it goes back, cease to do evil, learn to do good, tame your mind. These are the Buddha's teachings. And those four lines, there you'll hear them quoted again and again. They're really, really good to take to heart. As you work with them or as your practice matures, you'll find that there's many, many levels just in those. Ceasing to do evil, that stops us from harming other beings. And it's the basis of morality. Learn to do good is the basic expression of compassion, of helping others. Taming your mind, this is the quality that Buddhism, probably more than any other religious tradition, emphasizes, because it's what makes everything else possible. And as you come to be able to form a relationship with this thing we call mind so that we can actually form intention, rest in attention, then everything becomes possible and we can come to know the nature of experience and be freed from the projections of thought and self. So this is a four-line summary of the Buddha's teachings. It's something that's well worth memorizing, taking to heart, and just keeping with one. I mean, I heard Rinpoche so many times and translate so many times, I didn't have any choice about memorizing it. But maybe you do. Now, what I'd like you to do over the next week I know you've done something like this before, but I'd like you to revisit it. In both your meditation and in your daily life, I would like you to experiment, and this is in keeping with the vow of individual freedom. When you contemplate or actually do something unwholesome, what effect does that have in you? And when you contemplate or actually do something that is wholesome or virtuous, what effect does that have in you? And again, as we've done with, all along here, physically what arises, emotionally what arises, in terms of awareness what arises. It's good to revisit this again and again because it's very, very important. And the clearer we can be about that, the sounder basis we have for how we actually act in the world. And in that way, determine the environment we're creating for ourselves, for our practice, and for our lives. Okay, any questions on that? Okay. Thank you very much. And Joe, can you...
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast or any portion thereof with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in unfettered mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.